morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking about medical malpractice. We're going to be speaking about art and electroacoustic music, all of that yet to come. But right now, Linda Siegel is joining us with today's legislative update. Welcome, Linda.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
So, lots of things going on at the legislature. Closed door meetings have closed doors still.
Yes, indeed.
What else is happening? Court-ordered medical treatment for mental health patients?
Yes, I think you heard about those on Dal's report.
Right.
Some other issues which were very hot yesterday. A bill to create domestic partnerships for people who are gay or straight passed the House of Representatives 33-24. And what that bill says is that people who choose to can go down to their local county clerk's office and register as domestic partners, and then they get pretty much the same rights and responsibilities of marriage, but it's not marriage. It's called domestic partnerships. And this is for gay people, straight people, senior citizens who want to be able to keep their benefits, but if they married, they couldn't do it. And that has passed the House and will now be over in the Senate.
Let's say that I am a person who enters into a domestic partnership with somebody from another country. Would that help their immigration status, or does that still have to be marriage?
Well, that still has to be marriage, because what this statewide domestic partnership does is only applies to state benefits. And, of course, the immigration issue is a federal issue.
Right, right. So that moves on to the Senate. What does support look like over there?
Well, that moves on to the Senate, and while the House was debating that, the Senate was debating a bill that would have, at least initially how the bill was written, would have allowed for domestic partner insurance. So if you worked for an employer who wanted to offer insurance to your domestic partner, this law would have enabled that. And what happened in the Senate is the language domestic partner got amended out and changed to household member, and of course was totally watered down. But even in that watered down state, it failed to pass the Senate. So I think the House bill is in for some trouble in the Senate.
There's that issue. What else is happening in the legislature?
Well, of course, we're at day 17. There's some interesting bills coming up today in committees in both the House and the Senate on medical malpractice. And I heard you're talking on that later
in
the show.
We are indeed, yes.
And those will be bills, I don't know if these are the same bills you're going to talk about, but these will be bills that talk about putting a cap on the non-economic damages that practitioners have to pay in the event of a malpractice lawsuit. Because, of course, malpractice rates are skyrocketing for many healthcare practitioners, and it's part of that whole problem that we have in healthcare with lots of uninsured people, lots of litigation, legitimate and not legitimate sometimes. So very hot issues in the legislature today.
There's also a memorial that is moving through, or that is trying to move through, that would enable the uranium industry to overcome any barriers to uranium mining in the state of New Mexico. What do you know about that?
Yes, well, that's a memorial that Senator Ulibarri from Grants, who is an appointee, he's the person who the governor appointed to take Joe Fidel's place, who resigned because of health reasons. And I guess Grants is kind of uranium country, and his contention is that there are billions of dollars of uranium around in New Mexico, and that we should really be looking at how we can encourage the industry to start mining again and take away all the barriers to that we have environmentally to having that mining go on. And that memorial has actually passed one committee. I don't know what the status of it is now. I think it's in a second committee for hearing, so we'll see what happens. And, of course, a memorial only makes recommendations to departments in the state to do things. There's no force of law behind it, but I know many people are concerned that we don't need to be encouraging uranium mining in New Mexico.
So are environmental groups opposed to this memorial?
Yes, yes, and some health groups too, because of course when we look back at what happened on Navajo land with the mining before World War II and around World War II, lots of people are sick and dying, and lots of uranium miners very ill out into the future. So people are very concerned about this.
Linda Siegel, anything else you'd like to add before we go?
That's it for today, Mary Charlotte. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Linda Siegel is with us Monday, Wednesday, and Friday with the Legislative Update. We're going to hear one little announcement from our underwriters. Stay tuned to KSFR. We'll be right back.
In celebration of its 10th anniversary, the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum invites you to an intimate conversation between Gail Sheehy and Marilyn Mason on the pursuit of the passionate life at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, March 7th at the James A. Little Theater. Gail Sheehy is an award-winning literary journalist, editor of Vanity Fair, and the author of several bestsellers, including Passages, Sex and the Seasoned Woman, and The Silent Passage. This lecture is the kickoff to a year-long series of events commemorating 2007, the Year of O'Keeffe, as declared by the Santa Fe City Council and New Mexico's state legislature. For more information on the George O'Keeffe Museum and any of the 10th anniversary events, visit o'keeffemuseum.org or phone 946-1039. For tickets to the Gail Sheehy event on Wednesday, March 7th, call the Lensic at 988-1234. The George O'Keeffe Museum is a tax-exempt organization.
I'd like now to welcome Merchant Adams. He's curator of Home Wreckers, which is the second in an exhibition of an artist collective called Strange Weeds, and Nate Doyle, who's also an artist in this exhibition. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Yes, Mayor Charlotte.
It's great to have you here. What is the Home Wrecker Project, Merchant?
The Home Wrecker Project is the second installation of Strange Weeds, which is sort of a loosely artist co-op here that was just recently founded a couple months ago in Santa Fe. My whole deal with Home Wreckers was to bring in people who had not been displayed in Santa Fe before, the general area, and bring them together and see how they behave in an established sort of local group. So basically trying to bring in some fresh blood.
The name Home Wreckers is pretty loaded.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm kind of known for those sort of things with my title. So, just basically maybe shameless publicity or trying to get something to get some sort of attention with it. But
so it's not about adulterers per se.
No, no one really went that route with it. I mean, I was sort of, I guess if I had put my own work in this one, it might have gone that route, but it's pretty PG-13 for the most part, maybe with a couple exceptions.
So what is actually the curatorial theme of the project?
The curatorial theme of the project was something that would shake up. One of the reasons why I wanted outside people is I think a lot of these, these kind of projects like Strange Weeds, I think, are very well-intentioned and are important. But because of the size of the community here, I think it runs the risk of becoming recycled very quickly. So you need someone to come in and kind of shake things up a little bit.
So basically it's art in all possible themes, and the theme is that people are from outside of here.
Yeah, I think that I left it open enough to where I think certain themes can sort of be drawn from it. Like, I think most of the home wrecking aspects of it are more, like with Nate's work, you have sort of like these iconic images of George Bush. I think he would be sort of almost a mythical home wrecker at this time. And then another artist, Kim Martinez, has these like sort of superhero women of color, which have a very aggressive presence. You know, they look like they could wreck some homes if they wanted to, certainly.
Nate Doyle, what's your work about?
This set of work is about, you know, politics, religion, all the stuff that you really wouldn't want to talk about. Things that can...
At the dinner table.
Yeah, exactly. It's not really dinner table kind of conversation pieces. But the funny thing is that's where people are going to have dinner. It's also... It's kind of the stuff that would kind of separate homes and families. But at the same time, I feel like they're intimate and that they bring you in and they're not really going to separate you off from anybody else. So... they're kind of nice things, paintings that you can look at that sometimes can get under your skin.
Now, this is all happening starting on March 3rd, and the exhibition is taking place at the Tsuki Village Market. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Sort of the owners at the market, I guess, wanted to. They've been generous enough to offer up the space. So we have the Strange Weeds. The first show just went down. This one's going up on Saturday, and they've been generous enough to try to offer up the space as far as getting in an alternative to some of the contemporary art that goes on in the city. So yeah, it's been very nice of them.
What's a restaurant venue like?
Well, you know, for me, I've been on this show pitching my other curatorial projects like Renters and things that were really kind of off of the scope as far as traditional exhibitions go. So this is kind of
Well, you did
breeze.
Something in the woods.
Yeah, camp also. We got snowed out. And I think they're doing that one again. So I'm sure Christina will be willing to talk to you about that later. But this was like a really traditional show for me, so it was kind of easy, you know. It's like, and unfortunately, like with my injury, I mean, Nate and another artist,
Merchant
Laura
is
Nickel.
Sitting here with a cast around his
yeah, I've got a
very
massage
injured-looking hand.
Yeah,
Homewrecker's
gonna wreck Merchant more than anybody else.
Yeah, I think that's how it went. But
hand wreckers.
I did like that though, having people to sort of direct and like put that over here, you hang that there. So it's sort of nice, but a very easy. Easy show for the most part. Aside from almost electrocuting ourselves on a live wire, I think we did all right. So.
Yeah, and I had actually had some experience setting up shows in New York. I set up a Wavy Gravy and Jerry Garcia show. So.
Now, tell us about the Strange Weeds Collective.
Okay, Strange Weeds is a loose organization of artists. You can get some more information on that on www.strangeweeds.com. But it's basically a local co-op. The person that introduced me to the concept of it was Beverly Ash, who was supposed to be here today but wasn't. But it was basically a loose collaborative of artists that are trying to find independent and self-funded ways to get their work out. And so they use this sort of Tsuke Village Market and other local projects as well as trying to break into art fairs and stuff like that. And having one or two people do that can be rather difficult, but when you get a co-op of about 15 to 20, the finances become much more possible. And I think the name comes from the weeds being particularly sort of pervasive and sturdy, and just being able to sort of plant themselves wherever they can and sort of take root.
It's a little bit of that grassroots aspect, too.
Yeah.
Now, are these artists who have something in common, either aesthetically, in terms of medium, or anything else?
Yeah, most of these are going to be drawings and paintings, so I think like, for me, they make sense together. A lot of the work, there's five artists in there, and they it works together well for me. And I sort of picked them, I picked these people because I thought it would just sort of look together all right. So the other artists in there are going to be Laura Nickel, who does these fantastic wildlife in dilemmas, you know, like squirrels who can't get the bag of marshmallows sort of paintings, and Cody Berry does these sort of Harry Who-ish Chicago imagist images.
Squirrels who can't get the bag of marshmallows.
It's a terrible
dilemma.
Was
it a metaphor for all of us?
Yeah, I think so. Two skunks who scare each other. Stuff like that. I mean, it's really kind of funny stuff. Cody Berry does these sort of Chicago imagist / Harry Who kind of little intricate drawings. And Wagner Whitehead, who has these drawings with these weird, disturbing Photoshop partnerings that look like snapshots. But they play on... I guess he uses his images of his body in relation to colloquialisms and sayings, but I think they translate more into Portuguese, so they kind of are a little bizarro for us. But
tell us, Nate, a little bit about your background as an artist.
Well, I grew up in California, and I also went to school in Sedona, Arizona. But I've been here a painter at College of Santa Fe for 4 years. I'm going to be graduating this semester.
And you're a student of Merchant's?
I was. In the freshman year, Merchant was teaching several of my classes, actually. And so we got to know each other pretty well, and the art always kind of worked for that. But I also spent some time in New York City working for Alex Gray and with Marvel Comics. And so I've got a drawing also up in the show, too, as well as my paintings. And so, you know, it's on a comic board. But, yeah, comic books and paintings, and, you know, it's just something that I try to do what I'm interested in, so religion, politics, you know, Gnosticism, alchemy, all that other stuff.
Well, all of this is happening at the Tsuki Village Market. The opening reception is March 3rd, that's Saturday, from 6 to 9 in the evening. And how long will the work be hanging there?
We are up till April 28th. Also at the opening, we have DJ Dynamic, who's going to be out there doing some
KSFR's own DJ Dynamic.
No, you got to love him. You got to love the Brazilians.
he's amazing.
Yeah, he's really good. And so he's been nice enough to come out and spin some stuff for us. So it should be a really big thing. And I think if it's anything like the last one, guys, get out there. Early. This thing filled up very quickly last time. This is not the Santa Fe hour. Does not apply, I guess, to Tsuki, it seems. So try to get your space in there. It's tight.
Well, Merchant Adams and Nate Doyle, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks a lot, Mary Charlotte.
Yeah,
see you around.
So much.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking about medical malpractice. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome by telephone Bruce Thompson. He is an attorney practicing in Albuquerque, and he's here to talk to us about the Professional Medical Liability Act, which is both a Senate bill and a House bill. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
It's good to have you here. Now, we've been speaking with Linda Siegel about medical malpractice from the point of view of capping non-economic damages as a way of bringing down insurance costs. What is your point of view about this? What would this Professional Medical Liability Act actually do?
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned caps, because that's a really important part of this bill. Overall, it's a very complicated bill and a huge bill, but the caps, I think, are the most important thing to focus on. From my perspective, in my practice, I do represent a lot of injured, those who are injured by the mistakes of others, and some of them are medical malpractice claims. The problem with caps, from my perspective, is that they're fine. The $250,000 cap is just fine when it comes to smaller claims and people who are not seriously injured. I can think of an example in my own practice here at our firm. We had a case several years ago of a child who presented to the ER with a broken arm, but the radiologist didn't see that on the X-ray. It was sort of hidden, but they missed it, and they knew they missed it, as a result, the child was sent away without the proper cast. And it wasn't a catastrophic injury, because what ended up happening is the child needed an extra surgery that he wouldn't have otherwise needed, and he needed some physical therapy after the surgery to rehabilitate. And then periodically, as he grew up, as his bones grew and knitted together, he needed some care. So $250,000 in that context is adequate to cover that child's injuries. The problem becomes when you have medical mistakes that result in catastrophic injuries. And, the injuries that I'm thinking of are catastrophic brain injury, quadriplegia, patients who require ventilator care for the rest of their lives. I can tell you that those patients will need considerably more than $250,000 to compensate them for their injuries.
So, and what happens if there is a cap?
Well, in that case, what happens is the insurance company for the hospital or medical provider gets to pay the $250,000 and walk away. They basically wash their hands of it, and the risk. Well, I should say the liability for those medical payments into the future for the rest of that person's life falls on the taxpayers. We're talking in some cases about millions of dollars over the years. You know, in excess of $100,000 per year for instance, brain injured patients or ventilator dependent patients. And if their lives go on for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, that's a considerable amount of money that the taxpayers will have to pay rather than, the hospital or the medical provider that made the mistake.
We're talking to Bruce Thompson. Are you saying that if you had a bill such as the one that's being considered in the New Mexico legislature that would cap non-economic damages, I mean, well, we'll talk about the non-economic part in a moment, but would cap damages, then the liability would be transferred from the insurance company to the taxpayer?
That's exactly right, and that's why this bill is supported so heavily by the insurance industries and the insurance lobbyists. To my knowledge, this bill is not supported by the New Mexico Medical Association. And in fact, if you look at the AMA website, that's the American Medical Association, I just looked at their website today, and there's a page called Medical Liability Crisis Map. And if you look at that map, it's easy to find from their website. New Mexico is listed as one of seven states in the country where there is no medical malpractice crisis at all. And so this is not a bill that's supported by doctors necessarily. This is a bill that's supported by insurance companies because these caps are a huge boon for them, and they get to pass off the risk of medical mistakes to the taxpayer.
Now, is it not true that if you do cap damages, then the price, at least of malpractice insurance for doctors and so on, goes down?
That's not true. That's something that they would have us believe, but the reality is very different. And in fact, in the states that have passed similar legislation and that have passed caps on medical malpractice claims, the reality is that the insurance premiums have either stayed the same or continued to go up. And when you look behind the numbers, you see that the rates of premiums are more closely tied to investments, that is, to the stock market. And you can actually track over the years how insurance premiums go up and down with respect to the success of the stock market. And so it doesn't track at all with the number of medical malpractice claims or the amount of medical malpractice claims. Those have stayed relatively stable and predictable over time when you look at large numbers. You know, if you look statewide, those numbers are very predictable, but the stock market isn't. And so in my view, I mean, from my perspective, I don't think it's right to say, and it's not fair to say, that premiums will go down, because that has not been the experience in other states that have passed these bills.
We're talking to Attorney Bruce Thompson. You are in a group of people that is really demonized by the media, namely lawyers who represent clients who've been injured in one way or another. But you also have a point of view that the rest of us don't really have, which is injured people who, in fact, have been wronged by the system coming to you. What does it look like for you doing your job? I mean, what kind of things do you see? Is it doctors? Is it nursing homes? What kind of problems do you see coming into your office?
Well, that's a good question, because it is a very broad spectrum, and I have to say that in the specific context of medical mistakes, the risk of those mistakes falls disproportionately on the poor, and the reason is simple, because they don't have the kind of assets and other health insurance available that wealthier people may. And so in a lot of ways, I see my practice focusing on people who just don't have the assets otherwise to pay for the health care that they need. And they're often in desperate straits. I mean, they're often, these are very serious injuries often, and they often lose their jobs or they lose other sources of income. And it's a very unique, I think, perspective that I have that the general population wouldn't necessarily see, because these injuries are relatively rare. I mean, they're relatively, you know, sort of scattered around the state, and I don't think all of your listeners necessarily know someone that's been injured in a nursing home, for instance, or injured in a hospital. But the cases that we see are few, but they affect the patient in dramatic, life-changing ways that they no longer can support themselves in many cases.
Now, the bill, at least as it was worded when Linda Siegel was talking earlier, says it puts a cap on non-economic damages. Would that mean that for economic damages, in other words, the lifetime of a person who needs medical care for the next 30 years, that would not be covered under this bill?
Well, there are a couple of things to consider. This bill has some conflicting elements to it that I don't yet exactly how they would play out, I think it will have some unintended consequences. The bill only requires medical providers to have $250,000 in insurance coverage. Now, that's different from a cap, only having $250,000 in insurance coverage means that's it. That's all that there is for any given claim. Now, the cap on non-economic damages, that, as she probably pointed out, is different from future medical expenses, for instance, or past medical expenses. And those provisions have some very worrying elements to them. For instance, the future, with respect to the future medical expenses, the bill lays out a system whereby the injured patient has to come back periodically and prove what their future medical care is and get the insurance company to pay for it again. And that creates a system where they're never made whole. They're constantly trying to get an insurance company to pay for the rest of their lives. I mean, assuming that a lifelong injury, they continuously have to hire a lawyer to fight the insurance company, and that could mean 4, 5, 7, 10 lawsuits in the future to try to get them to pay. And those are what I consider frivolous lawsuits. I have a different perspective on the phrase frivolous lawsuits. And if my clients have to sue their own insurance company for benefits, that to me strikes me as frivolous. But to answer your question, the bill is fairly complex, and I think it will have unintended consequences with respect to other areas of damages other than non-economic.
Last question that I wanted to ask you. If a person has the right to bring lawsuits against an institution or a doctor or a nursing home or whatever it is, does that have the consequence of getting that institution to provide better care, have better standards, be more careful, or does it just simply put a burden on the institution?
Well, to be fair, I think that the answer to that depends on who you ask. From my perspective, what I see is a regulatory system that is completely broken. There is no we're living in a sort of cultural climate where corporations want deregulation. They do not want to be regulated for patient safety or patient welfare. And so the executive branch, the legislative branch, these branches of government really aren't protecting patient safety. And so from my perspective, I would argue that patients who are injured and who bring claims for mistakes that were preventable induce or encourage the nursing homes and medical providers and hospitals to enhance their patient safety, and it's just a common thing. It's a matter of risk prevention, and trying to see how patient care can be enhanced. And these kinds of lawsuits are unfortunately one of the only ways for us as consumers to make sure that hospitals do their jobs.
Well, Bruce Thompson, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Bruce Thompson is an attorney practicing in Albuquerque, and the bill we're talking about is the Professional Medical Liability Act, Senate Bill 944 and House Bill 970. Bruce.
And Mary Charlotte, if I could.
Yes.
I'd just like to say that there are important votes in committees going on today. And so even if, 10 or 15 of your listeners called their representative today, it could make a huge difference. And in Santa Fe, on the House side, it's the Health and Government Affairs Committee. On the House side, their representative, Lucky Varela, I wonder if I could give his phone number.
Go for it.
Would that be all right?
Yeah.
986-4318. And on the Senate side, Phil Griego is likely your listener's senator. His number is 986-4861.
Bruce Thompson, thanks for being with us. We're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about electroacoustic music. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome David Dunn. He is the composer in residence of the Electroacoustic Music Festival, and Stephen Miller, faculty member, musician, faculty member at the College of Santa Fe, and mover and shaker in this whole business. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hi.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. Now, okay, it's the 11th annual Santa Fe International Festival of Electroacoustic Music, and it's happening this weekend. Electroacoustic music, that sounds like an oxymoron.
Well, some people might say it is, but actually it's much more common than people think, in the sense that these days it's almost impossible to hear music that isn't both electric and acoustic, in the sense that most people experience their music via the media, whether that's recordings or the radio or whatever. But this really goes deeper than that and tries to look at the idea of using primarily recording media as the compositional medium itself. So it started in the 40s and 50s with, you know, guys in lab coats cutting up tape and making weird sounds, and evolved over the next 50, 60 years to really look at the idea of acoustic sounds in tandem with electronic resources, a lot of times processing, transforming acoustic sounds, and then playing even purely electronic sounds, playing them over speakers and hearing them acoustically. So it tries to be a little bit more inclusive than just this stodgy old term, electronic music.
Although I still wear a lab coat.
Yeah. The lab coat hasn't gone away in some circles.
Now, David Dunn, tell us about the music that you're working on and how your, history of your work in electroacoustic music has evolved.
Well, following up on your last segment, I'm actually speaking as an advocate for musical malpractice. That's my major focus.
Can you say more about that?
Well, just to talk just briefly about my own work, most of the music that I make as a composer seldom involves traditional musical instruments. It hasn't for quite a few years, although I still once in a while will be blackmailed into writing a piece for traditional instruments. But
well, you grew up playing the violin.
I did.
And he still does.
I still do, once in a while. And had a long history as a performer, playing all sorts of things, early music and classical music, and playing in opera pit orchestras. And when I was a youngster, I made a living primarily for a period of time as a freelance performing musician. But my primary interest alongside of that has always been more this, what kinds of sounds you can explore and make, and the idea of using the technologies that now surround us as part of the cultural environment that we're born into. And the idea very early on for me was that to the extent that artists don't embrace or use these sorts of tools and resources, it would be the extent to which those tools and resources control us, and that the agenda gets set by commercial and industrial forces for their interests and not for really creative interests. So I've always seen a kind of responsibility for artists to use the new technologies and to see how they can be spirited in directions that are more creative and humane, I should say.
Yeah.
So toasters, rockets, vacuum cleaners, trucks. How do you use them electroacoustic music?
Well, there's certainly, very early on, there was this realization that these were extraordinary sounds of their own accord, and that not only are they just interesting things to listen to, but that they have characteristics that can be manipulated and changed and worked into other kinds of schemes and strategies for sound and art making. So it isn't just looking at it from the standpoint of the sort of traditional musical values that we ordinarily associate with classical tradition or popular musics, but really exploring, using sound and creatively as a vehicle through which we can actually sensitize ourselves to the environment that surrounds us.
It's funny because a lot of the industrial environment that surrounds us, we try to desensitize ourselves because it sounds so horrible.
Well, a lot of that has to do with how we get through our day.
I mean, I actually moved to Santa Fe, and a large part of the reason was because I couldn't stand the soundscape in the big city on the East Coast that I was living in.
Uh-huh. I totally sympathize.
Part of the agenda, though, with a lot of the type of music that David's referring to is specifically to get people to engage their sonic environment wherever they are with a healthy sense of curiosity. Now, there's no doubt that extremely loud industrial sounds, you know, he's standing on the side of the tracks when the train goes by and stuff like that, those can physically be dangerous. But on the other hand, to the extent that people try and shut things out, which our ears not being able to close, they really can't, you build in frustration, where if you can learn to listen with some degree of curiosity about the nature of sound and how sound changes and how your perspective on your world changes according to the sounds you're hearing, you can actually find, and many people have actually found, that once they kind of develop that, those kinds of soundscapes are no longer seen as oppressive. They may not be what you prefer, but they're no longer, they don't cause your you know, blood pressure to go through the roof anymore, you know. So in a sense, this also, many people can think of this as a strategy of learning how to deal with urbanization.
Well, it sounds like there's a real analogy to certain kinds of modern art where you paint a picture of an industrial landscape or you take found garbage and frame it in a way that it becomes something else.
Yeah, to aestheticize that which is normally rejected and to find interest in it as part of the world that we actually live in, and rather than just out of hand rejecting it. But I must say, as a composer, there are many composers who are interested in those kinds of industrial sounds. Personally, I'm not one of them. I don't work a whole lot with urban bass sounds. I work more with the opposite of that, the natural soundscape. But for
we've had you talking on here about the sounds that bark beetles make.
Yeah, and there'll be some bark beetles in the concert on Thursday night.
Are they singing live?
No, they're it's their greatest hits.
David will be lip syncing the Beatles.
Yes, that's right.
No pun intended. Yes.
Love me do. So how do you record animal sounds or insect sounds or nature sounds, and what makes the transition into those sounds becoming music?
Well, I think I would take the position that they are innately music. They're part of the communicative structure of these non-human life forms, and that's specifically the thing I'm most interested in, is actually providing evidence and creating works which help to articulate and bring into the foreground what I believe to be the fact of that these sounds are communicative, that they're the evidence of purposeful-minded systems that exist in the world, and are extraordinarily sophisticated forms of mind that we more and more constantly are being revealed to us as that. And so they are innately musical, I think, in the sense that one of my favorite theories of music currently is that both music and speech, human speech, actually evolved from a common ancestor, that they're a branching of some sort of proto-linguistic form, and that what I personally think is that music has been this kind of conserving action for keeping alive a modality of communication that is more similar to the means of communication we find in the non-human world.
Very interesting. Well, when you think of music, traditionally you think of somebody constructing something that contains rhythm, harmony, and melody. Do you find those elements?
Absolutely. And surprisingly so. Often, when we start to study and record those kinds of sounds, flow of elements and parameters that we associate with even traditional Western musicality become pretty self-evident.
So you have the Bark Beetle Tabernacle Choir?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
The idea that you can find these things out in nature really isn't all that surprising, though, because, I mean, all you're really talking about are the rate of flow of musical events, and whether they're higher or lower pitched, that's a basic description of a melody, right? And so if you tune your ears to be able to hear melodies not just on instruments, but wherever you hear pitched sounds coming and going, you can follow the melody of, you know, a river or what have you. So it's really not that big a stretch to be able to listen to nature or any kind of sounds with the same kind of musical ear you would listen to Beethoven or Brahms, you know.
Should we hear one of the excerpts that you have brought for us,
sure,
David?
Sure. Actually, since you're speaking of the sounds of nature, probably the one that might be most appropriate at this point. This is a part of one of the works that will be performed on the festival. This is which is called Five Micro Worlds. And there are five recordings, field recordings, and what makes them all unique is that they all are sounds that our ears cannot ordinarily hear. They're in places and in acoustical mediums other than air where we are in frequency ranges beyond the capacity of the human ear to resolve. So in this case, it's sounds of ants. These are western harvester ants, a common species here in New Mexico. They make very high mounds. And this is a special, in all the cases, these are invented devices that I've made to be able to record these special acoustical substrates. In this case, it's an ant nest about 2 feet down into the ground.
So you've put a little ant microphone 2 feet down?
A tiny little microphone that goes 2 feet down into the nest itself. And the ants do what is called stridulation. And in this case, the stridulatory organ is on their little rear end called the gaster. And it's sort of like they're playing a kind of like a güiro or a Latin percussion instrument, which is scraping against a friction surface.
Their little leg is scraping against a little friction surface on their back?
Not the leg. There's actually a patch on the top of the gaster and then a kind of plectrum that overhangs that. So they're playing this musical instrument by shaking their little booty.
So ant booty shaking. Let's hear it. Dal Dierman is on in the control room. Let's hear the excerpt called Ants. Now, David Dunn, unless you are deeply involved in a kind of mystical shamanism, you don't know what the ants are doing or saying by their sounds, do you?
Well, there have certainly been scientists who are called myrmecologists, ant biologists, who have studied to some extent, not very extensively, but to some extent, the sounds that ants make. And in the case of these ants, which are known as Pogonomyrmex occidentalis, they've been studied.
There will be a quiz. Go ahead.
Yeah. Easy for you to say.
They are more. The sound making is better known than amongst other species, and they actually make these sounds as communicative. And one of the theories is also that they're using sound to actually modulate the sound pressure waves to modulate their olfactory communication.
Now, again, I mean, this sort of is the borderline between art and science, which you seem to do a lot of your work on. What's the art piece of it?
I would say that it's because I'm an artist.
Now, just wait a minute. I mean, you play this at a concert. I mean, I can imagine making your little microphone, putting it 2 feet in the ground, getting it out, being stunned and delighted. But again, I mean, how is it a musical composition?
Well, how is it not?
Well, how is it not a scientific record?
It's
and
that
just
too.
Merely that.
It is definitely a scientific record.
I think, you know, part of the real breakthrough of a lot of contemporary music of the last 50 years has been, or and even longer, really, going back to the early part of the 20th century, has been a real attempt to open up the world of music to sounds and sound structures formerly kind of prohibited, you know, starting with Varese in the teens and 20s and John Cage in the 30s and 40s and all of these kind of folks, and particularly in the world of electroacoustic music, embracing sounds that may not foreground melody and harmony and kind of the typical cyclical rhythm that we would think of, is a real major aspect of where the interest level is intended and experienced in these music. So when I listen to David's music of Nature Sounds, in addition to hearing ants and thinking about what's going on, I'm also listening to the rich timbres, the textures, the changing density of sounds, the way the individual sounds change over time, and the perspective that you have just in terms of musically experiencing sound. So,
it takes a different kind of listener than it takes you know, somebody who's going to the Rolling Stones concert, let's say. I mean, it takes a quietness, a slowing down, perhaps.
I think that's often true. I would just say it's not inherently a different kind of listener. It's a listener who's kind of grown the capacity to listen in that way, and that's not something, you know, like many people will say about talent, either you got it or you don't. You know, anybody
the ants who got
takes
it.
The ants got it, but the listeners can develop that. You know, I remember as a youngster, you know, playing in rock bands and hearing my first electroacoustic music and thinking, what the heck is all this noise? What's all the big deal about? You know, and here I am some years later, and it's a you know, main area of my creative output. So I don't think it's unusual for people to be able to develop the idea of, or the ability, excuse me, to listen musically to just about anything.
Well, it certainly is an opportunity for people to go into an environment they haven't heard before.
They can't hear otherwise.
And that they can't hear otherwise, exactly. And in terms of the Electroacoustic Music Festival, which is this weekend, it starts tomorrow.
Yeah, Thursday,
and goes
Friday,
through
Saturday.
The weekend. Tell us some of the details. There's all sorts of folks besides you two. Joan LaBarbera will be there.
Mm-hmm.
Diane Thome. Live performances Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at Benildis Hall at the College of Santa Fe.
Right.
There's also some sound installations.
Yeah. So Thursday night is David's concert. Friday night is Joan LaBarbera and Diane Thome. And Saturday night we're doing a memorial concert for James Tenney, a noted American composer, experimental composer. And there's also been a series of radio broadcasts. There's also two sound installation works in an ambient sound gallery we have going 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in the lobby of Benildis Hall. The one that's currently up that is running through tomorrow is by a Japanese artist, Sawako, and it's basically sonification of like Wi-Fi transmissions and all kinds of the radio frequencies that you would hear turned into sound.
Well, you can find out more about this by going to SFIFEM, Santa Fe International Festival of Electroacoustic Music, that's the acronym, .csf.edu, or just Google the whole thing on the internet. Is there a phone number that people can call?
Yeah, people can call the music program office at the College of Santa Fe, and that number is 473-6196. They can also reserve tickets or just get more info, etc.
Well, David Dunn and Stephen Miller, thank you so much for being with us here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Dal Dierman for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, good morning, jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow we're going to spend the hour with author Gail Sheehy, who's going to be in Santa Fe soon, and we'll be talking to her on the Radio Cafe. So keep your dial tuned or your computer to KSFR's, to Santa Fe's only public radio station, KSFR. Hasta la vista. Ciao.